Chapter 20. The Middle Ages awaited the hero of the Grail and expected that the head of the Holy Roman Empire would become an image and a manifestation of that King of the World. The invisible emperor was to become also the visible one, and the Middle Ages would be middle in the sense of central, the invisible, inviolable center, the sovereign who must reawaken, the same hero avenging and restoring. These are not fantasies of a dead romantic past, but rather the simple truth for those who, today, alone can legitimately call themselves alive. Julius Evola, Il Mistero del Graal, Rome, Edizioni Mediterranee, 1983, Chapter 23, and Epilogue.
"You mean the Grail also comes into this?" Belbo asked.
"Naturally. And I'm not the only one who says so. You are educated men. There is no need for me to go into the legend of the Grail. The Knights of the Round Table, the mystical quest for this miraculous object, which some believe was the chalice in which the blood of Jesus was collected. The Grail taken to France by Joseph of Arimathea. Others say it is a stone that possesses mysterious powers. The Grail is often depicted as a dazzling light. It's a symbol representing power, a source of immense energy. It nourishes, heals wounds, blinds, strikes down. Some have thought of it as the Philosopher's Stone of the alchemists. But even if that's so, what was the Philosopher's Stone if not a symbol of some cosmic energy? The literature on the subject is endless, but you can easily distinguish signs that are irrefutable. In Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parzival, the Grail is said to be kept in a Templar castle. Was Eschenbach an initiate? A foolhardy writer who revealed too much? But there is more. This Grail, kept by the Templars, is described as a stone fallen from the heavens. Lapis exilis. It's not clear whether the expression means stone from heaven, ex coelis, or stone from exile. But in either case, it is something that comes from far away, and some suggest that it could have been a meteorite. As far as we're concerned, however, it is definitely a stone. Whatever the Grail may have been, for the Templars it was the symbol of the objective, or the end of the plan.
Excuse me, I said, but the document indicates that the Knights' sixth meeting will be held near or above a stone. It doesn't tell them to find the stone.
Another subtle ambiguity, another luminous mystical analogy. Yes, indeed, the sixth meeting is to be held near a stone, and we shall soon see where. But at that stone, where the transmission of the plan is fulfilled and the six seals opened, the Knights will learn where to find the stone. It's like the pun in the New Testament. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock. On the stone you shall find the stone.
It's all quite obvious, Belbo said. Please go on. Kasaban, stop interrupting. We're all eager to hear the rest.
Well then, the Colonel said, the reference to the Grail made me think for a long time that the treasure was a huge deposit of radioactive material, perhaps of extraterrestrial origin. Consider, for example, the mysterious wound in the legend of King Amfortas.
The account makes him sound like a radiologist who has been dangerously exposed. He is not to be touched. Why not?
Imagine how excited the Templars must have been when they reached the shores of the Dead Sea, whose waters, as you gentlemen surely know, are so dense that on them you float like a cork. It is a sea with curative powers. They could have discovered a deposit of radium or uranium in Palestine, a deposit they weren't in a position to exploit then and there. The relationship between the Grail, the Templars, and the Cathars was investigated scientifically by a valiant German officer. I'm referring to Otto Rahn, an SS Obersturmbannführer, who devoted his life to rigorous scholarly study of the European and Aryan nature of the Grail. I won't go into why and how he lost his life in 1939, but some insist that, well, how can I forget what happened to Ingolf? In any case, Rahn demonstrated a link between the Golden Fleece of the Argonauts and the Grail. It's obvious that there's a connection between the Grail, the Philosopher's Stone, and the enormous power source that Hitler's followers were seeking on the eve of the war and pursued to their last breath. In one version of the Argonaut story, remember, they see a cup, mind you, floating over the mountain of the world with the Tree of Light. When the Argonauts find the Golden Fleece, their ship is magically borne into the Milky Way in the austral sky
where the luminous nature of God Eternal is made manifest by the Southern Cross, the Triangle, and the Altar. The Triangle symbolizes the Holy Trinity, the Cross, the Divine Sacrifice of Love, and the Altar is the Table of the Supper, on which stood the Cup of the Resurrection. The Celtic and Aryan origin of all these symbols is obvious. The colonel seemed caught in the same heroic ecstasy that had impelled his Obersturmendrang, or whatever the hell that German was, to the supreme sacrifice. Someone had to bring him down to earth. "Where is all this leading?" I asked. "Signor Kasabin, can't you see it for yourself? The Grail has been called the Luciferian Stone, which points to the figure of Baphomet. The Grail is a power source. The Templars were the guardians of an energy secret, and they drew up their plan accordingly. Where would the unknown commanderies be established? Where, gentlemen?" And the colonel looked at us with a conspiratorial air, as if we were all in the plot together. "I had a trail to follow, erroneous but useful. In 1797, Charles-Louis Cadet de Gassicourt, an author who must have overheard some secrets, wrote a book entitled Le Tombeau de Jacques Molay, ou Le Secret des Conspirateurs à ceux qui veulent tout savoir. By an interesting coincidence, his work turned up in Ingolf's little library. He claims that Molay, before his death, set up 4 secret lodges in Paris, Scotland, Stockholm, and Naples. These 4 lodges were to exterminate all monarchs and destroy the power of the Pope. Gassicourt was an eccentric, of course, but I used his idea as a starting point from which to determine where the Templars might have located their secret centers. I wouldn't have been able to understand the enigmas of the message if I hadn't had some guiding idea. But I did have such an idea. It was my conviction, based on abundant evidence, that the Templar spirit was of Celtic, Druidic origin. It was the spirit of the Nordic Aryanism, traditionally associated with the island of Avalon, seat of the legendary civilization of the far north. As you surely know, various authors have identified Avalon as the Garden of the Hesperides, or as Ultima Thule, or as the Colchis of the Golden Fleece. It's hardly an accident that history's greatest chivalric order was La Toison d'Or, the Order of the Golden Fleece, which makes it clear what the word castle in the message really means. It refers to the Hyperboreal, the northernmost castle, where the Templars kept the Grail, probably the mythical Montsalvat. He paused, wanting us to hang on his every word. We hung. Now let's go back to the second command in the message. The guardians of the seal are to go to a place associated with bread. This instruction is completely clear. The Grail is the chalice that contained Christ's blood, the bread is Christ's body, the place where the bread was eaten is the place of the Last Supper, Jerusalem. It seems impossible that the Templars wouldn't have maintained a secret base there, even after the Saracen reconquest. I must admit that at first I was troubled by this Jewish element in a plan so deeply imbued with Aryan mythology. But then I realized, we are the ones who continue to regard Jesus as deriving from the Judaic religion, because that's what the Church of Rome has always taught us. But the Templars knew that Jesus was actually a Celtic myth. The whole gospel story is a hermetic allegory. Resurrection after dissolution in the bowels of the earth and all that. Christ is simply the elixir of the alchemists. For that matter, everyone knows that the Trinity is an Aryan concept anyway, and that's why the whole rule of the Templars, drawn up by the Druid St. Bernard, is riddled with the number 3. The colonel took another sip of water. He was hoarse. "And now we come to the third stage, the refuge. It's Tibet."
"Why Tibet?"
"Because in the first place, Eschenbach tells us the Templars left Europe and took the Grail to India. Cradle of the Aryan race. The refuge is Agartha. You gentlemen must have heard talk of Agartha, seat of the King of the World, the underground city from which the masters of the world control and direct the developments of human history. The Templars established one of their secret centers there, at the very source of their spirituality. You must be aware of the connection between the realm of Agartha and the Synarchy."
"Frankly, no."
"All the better. There are secrets that kill. But let's not digress. In any case, you know that Agartha was founded 6,000 years ago, at the beginning of the Kali Yuga era, in which we are still living. The task of the knightly orders has always been to maintain contact with Agartha, the active link between the wisdom of the East and the wisdom of the West. And now it's clear where the fourth meeting is to take place, in another Druidic sanctuary, in a city of the Virgin,
the Cathedral of Chartres. From Provins, Chartres lies across the chief river of the Île-de-France, the Seine.
We were completely lost.
Wait a minute, I said. What does Chartres have to do with your Celts and Druids?
Where do you think the idea of the Virgin came from? The first virgins mentioned in Europe were the black virgins of the Celts. Once, as a young man, St. Bernard was in the church of Saint-Voir, kneeling before the black virgin there, and she squeezed from her breast 3 drops of milk which fell on the lips of the future founder of the Templars. That was why the romances of the Grail arose, to create a cover for the Crusades, which were meant to find the Grail. The Benedictines are the heirs of the Druids. Everybody knows that.
And where are these black virgins now?
They were destroyed by forces who wanted to corrupt the Nordic and Celtic traditions and transform them into a Mediterranean religion by inventing the myth of Mary of Nazareth. Or else those virgins were disguised, distorted, like so many other black Madonnas still displayed to the fanaticism of the masses. But if you examine the images in the cathedrals as carefully as the great Fulcanelli did, you will find that this story is told quite clearly, and the ties between the Celtic virgins and the alchemist tradition, Templar in origin, are equally clear. The black virgin symbolizes the prime matter that seekers employ in their quest for the Philosopher's Stone, which, as we have seen, is simply the Grail. Where do you think Muhammad, another great Druid initiate, got the inspiration for the Black Stone of Mecca?
Someone walled up the crypt in Chartres that leads to the underground site where the original pagan statue still stands, but if you look carefully, you can still make out a black virgin, Notre-Dame du Pilier, carved by an Odinian canon. In her right hand, she holds the magic cylinder of the high priestesses of Odin. In her left, the magic calendar that once depicted, I say once, because these sculptures unfortunately were vandalized by orthodox canons, the sacred animals of Odinism. The dog, the eagle, the lion, the white bear, and the werewolf. At the same time, none of the scholars of Gothic esoterica has overlooked in Chartres a statue of a woman holding the chalice, the Grail. Ah, gentlemen, if only it were possible not just to read Chartres Cathedral according to the tourist guides, Roman, Catholic, and Apostolic, but to see it, really see it with the eyes of tradition. Then the true story told by that rock of Eric at Avalon would be known.
Which brings us to the Poplicans. Who were they?
The Cathars. Poplican, or Poplicant, was one of the names given to heretics. The Cathars of Provence had been destroyed, and I'm not so naive as to imagine a meeting in the ruins of Montségur, but the sect itself didn't die. There's a whole geography of hidden Catharism, which produced Dante, as well as the Dolce Stil Nuovo poets and the Fedeli d'Amore sect. The fifth meeting place is therefore somewhere in northern Italy or southern France.
And the last?
Ah, what is the most ancient, the most sacred, the most enduring of Celtic stones? The sanctuary of the sun god, most favored observation point from which finally the reunited descendants of the Templars of Provins, having reached the end of their plan, can look upon the secrets hidden till then by the seven seals, and at last discover how to exploit the immense power granted by their possession of the Holy Grail. Why, it's in England! The magic circle of Stonehenge, where else?
Oh, basta là, Bilbo said. Only another child of Piedmont could have understood the spirit in which this expression of polite amazement was uttered. No equivalent in any other language or dialect, dis donc, are you kidding, can convey the apathy, the fatalism with which it expresses the firm conviction that the person to whom it is addressed is irreparably the product of a bumbling creator. But the colonel wasn't from Piedmont, and he seemed flattered by Bilbo's reaction.
Yes, indeed. Such is the plan, the ordination in its marvelous simplicity and coherence. And there's something else. If you take a map of Europe and Asia and trace the development of the plan, beginning with the castle in the north, and moving from there to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to Agartha, from Agartha to Chartres, from Chartres to the shores of the Mediterranean, and from there to Stonehenge, you will find that you have drawn a rune that looks more or less like this.
And, Bilbo asked,
and the same rune, ideally, would connect the main centers of Templar esotericism. Amiens, Troyes, St. Bernard's domain at the edge of the Forêt d'Orient, Reims, Chartres, Rennes-le-Château and Mont-Saint-Michel, a place of ancient druidic worship. The rune also recalls the constellation of the Virgin.
I dabble in astronomy, Theotilevi said shyly. The Virgin has a different shape, and I believe it contains 11 stars.
The colonel smiled indulgently. Gentlemen, gentlemen, you know as well as I do that everything depends on how you draw the lines. You can make a wane or a bear, whatever you like, and it's hard to decide whether a given star is part of a given constellation or not. Take another look at the Virgin. Make speak of the lowermost point corresponding to the Provençal coast. Use only 5 stars, and you'll see a striking resemblance between the 2 outlines.
You just have to decide which stars to omit, Belbo said.
Precisely, the colonel agreed.
Listen, Belbo said, how can you rule out the possibility that the meetings did take place as scheduled, and that the knights are now hard at work?
Because I perceive no symptoms, and allow me to add, unfortunately. No, the plan was definitely interrupted, and perhaps those who were to carry it to its conclusion no longer exist. The groups of the 36 may have been broken up by some worldwide catastrophe, but some other group of men with spirit, men with the right information, could perhaps pick up the thread of the plot. Whatever it is, that something is still there. I'm looking for the right men. That's why I want to publish the book, to encourage reactions. And at the same time, I'm trying to make contact with people who can help me look for the answer in the labyrinth of traditional learning. Just today I managed to meet the greatest expert on the subject. But he, alas, luminary that he is, couldn't tell me anything, though he expressed great interest in my story and promised to write a preface.
Excuse me, Belbo asked, but wasn't it unwise to confide your secret to this gentleman? You told us yourself about Ingolf's misstep.
Please, the colonel replied. Ingolf was a bungler. The person I'm in contact with is a scholar above suspicion, a man who doesn't venture hasty conclusions. Today, for instance, he asked me to wait a little longer before showing my work to a publisher, until I had resolved all the controversial points. I didn't want to antagonize him, so I didn't tell him I was coming here, but I'm sure you can understand how impatient I am, having come this far in my work. The gentleman, oh, to hell with discretion, I don't want you to think I'm bragging idly. He is Rakowski.
He paused for our reaction. Belbo disappointed him.
Who? Rakowski! The Rakowski! The authority on traditional studies, the former editor of Les Cahiers du Mystère.
Oh, that Rakowski, Belbo said. Yes, yes, of course.
Before writing the final version of my book, I'll wait to hear this gentleman's advice. But I wanted to move as quickly as possible, and if I could come to an agreement with your firm in the meantime... As I said, I am eager to stir up reactions, to collect new information. There are people who surely know, but won't speak. Around 1944, gentlemen, though he knew the war was lost, Hitler began talking about a secret weapon that would allow him to turn the situation around. He was crazy, people said. But what if he wasn't crazy? You follow me?
His forehead was bathed in sweat, and his mustache bristled like a feline's whiskers.
In any event, he said, I'm casting the bait. We'll see if anyone bites.
From what I knew and thought of Belbo then, I expected him to show the colonel out with some polite words. But he didn't.
Listen, colonel, he said, this is enormously interesting, regardless of whether you sign a contract with us or with someone else. Do you think you could spare another 10 minutes or so?
He turned to me. It's late, Kasaubin, and I've kept you too long already. Can we meet tomorrow? I was being dismissed. Theotilevi took my arm and said he was leaving too. We said goodbye. The colonel shook Theotilevi's hand warmly and gave me a nod accompanied by a chilly smile. As we were going down the stairs, Theotilevi said to me, You're probably wondering why Belbo asked you to leave. Don't think he was being rude. He's going to make the colonel an offer. It's a delicate matter. Delicate by order of Signor Garamond. Our presence would be an embarrassment.
As I learned later, Belbo meant to cast the colonel into the maw of Minucius.
I dragged Theotilevi to Pilades, where I had a Campari and he a root beer. Root beer, he said, had a monkish archaic taste, almost Templar. I asked him what he thought of the colonel.
All the world's follies, he replied, turn up in publishing houses sooner or later. but the world's follies may also contain flashes of the wisdom of the Most High. So the wise man observes folly with humility. Then he excused himself. He had to go. "This evening a feast awaits me," he said.
"A party?"
He seemed dismayed by my frivolity.
"The Zohar," he explained.
"Lek Lekha. Passages still completely misunderstood."
Chapter 21. The Grail is a weight so heavy that creatures in the bondage of sin are unable to move it from its place. Wolfram von Eschenbach, Parzival, Roman 9, 477.
I hadn't taken to the Colonel, yet he had piqued my interest. You can be fascinated even by a tree frog if you watch it long enough. I was savoring the first drops of the poison that would carry us all to perdition. I went back to see Belbo the following afternoon, and we talked a little about our visitor. Belbo said the man had seemed a mythomaniac to him. "Did you notice how he quoted that Rakosky or Rostropovich as if the man were Kant?" "But these are typical old tales," I said. "Ingolf was a lunatic who believed them, and the Colonel is a lunatic who believes Ingolf." "Maybe he believed in him yesterday, and today he believes in something else. Before he left, I arranged an appointment for him with, well, with another publisher, a firm that's not choosy and brings out books financed by the authors themselves. He seemed enthusiastic, but I just learned that he didn't show up. And imagine, he even left the photocopy of that message here. Look, he leaves the secret of the Templars around as if it were of no importance. That's how these characters are." At this moment the phone rang. Belbo answered.
"Good morning, Garamond Press, Belbo speaking. What can I do for you?"
"Yes, he was here yesterday afternoon, offering me a book."
"Sorry, that's rather confidential. If you could tell me..."
He listened for a few seconds, then, suddenly pale, looked at me and said, "The Colonel's been murdered, or something of the sort." He spoke into the phone again. "Excuse me, I was talking to Signor Casaubon, a consultant of mine who was also present at yesterday's conversation." "Well, Colonel Ardenti came to talk to us about a project of his, a story I consider largely fabrication, about a supposed treasure of the Templars. They were medieval knights." Instinctively he put his hand around the mouthpiece as if to talk privately, then took his hand away when he saw I was watching. He spoke with some hesitation. "No, Inspector De Angelis, the Colonel discussed a book he wanted to write, but only in vague terms."
"What, both of us? Now?"
"All right, give me the address." He hung up and was silent for a while, drumming his fingers on the desk. "Sorry, Casaubon," he said. "I'm afraid I've dragged you into this. I didn't have time to think. That was a police inspector named De Angelis. It seems the Colonel was staying in an apartment hotel, and somebody claims to have found him there last night, dead."
"Claims? The inspector doesn't know if it's true or not?"
"It sounds strange, but apparently he doesn't. They found my name and yesterday's appointment in a notebook. I believe we're the only clue. What can I say? Let's go."
We called a taxi. During the ride, Belbo gripped my arm.
"Listen, Casaubon, this may be just a coincidence. Maybe my mind is warped. But where I come from, there's a saying, whatever you do, don't name names. When I was a boy, I used to go see this nativity play performed in dialect, a pious farce with shepherds who didn't know whether they were in Bethlehem or on the banks of the Tanaro, farther up the Po Valley. The magi arrive and ask a shepherd's boy what his master's name is. The boy answers, Jalindo. When Jalindo finds out, he beats the daylights out of the boy. Never give away a man's name, he says. Anyway, if it's all right with you, the Colonel never mentioned Ingolf or the Provam message."
"We don't want to meet Ingolf's mysterious end," I said, trying to smile.
"As I said, it's all nonsense, but there are some things it's better to keep out of." I promised I would go along with him on this, but I was nervous. After all, I was a student who participated in demonstrations. The police made me uneasy. We arrived at the hotel, not one of the best, in an outlying neighborhood. They sent us right up to what they called Colonel Ardenti's apartment. Police on the stairs. They led us into number 27.
2 + 7 = 9, I thought. A bedroom, vestibule with a little table, closet kitchen, bathroom with shower, no curtain. Through the half-open door, I couldn't see if there was a bidet, though in a place like this it was probably the only convenience the guests demanded. Drab furnishings, not many personal effects, but what there was in great disorder. Someone had hastily gone through the closets and suitcases. Maybe the police. There were about a dozen of them, including plainclothesmen. A fairly young man with fairly long hair came over to us. "I'm De Angelis. Dr. Belbo, Dr. Kasabin?" "I'm not a doctor yet, still working toward my degree." "Good for you, keep at it. Without a degree you won't be able to take the police exams, and you don't know what you're missing." He seemed irritated. "Excuse me, but let's get the preliminaries out of the way. This is the passport that belonged to the man who rented this room. He registered as Colonel Ardenti. Recognize him?" "That's Ardenti," Belbo said. "But can you tell us what's going on here? From what you said on the phone, I don't quite understand if he's dead or—" "I'd be delighted if you could tell me that," De Angelis said with a frown. "But all right, you gentlemen are probably entitled to know a bit more. Signor Ardenti, or Colonel Ardenti, checked in 4 days ago. As you may have noticed, this place isn't the Grand. The one desk clerk goes to bed at 11 because the guests have a key to the front door. There are a couple of maids who come in every morning to do the rooms, and an old alcoholic who acts as porter and takes liquor up to the rooms if the customers ring. Not only alcoholic, but arteriosclerotic, too. It was hell getting anything out of him. The desk clerk says the old man sees spooks and sometimes scares the guests. Last night the clerk saw Ardenti come in around 10 and go up to his room with two men. In this place they don't bat an eye if someone takes a whole troop of transvestites upstairs. The men looked normal, although according to the clerk they had foreign accents. At 10:30 Ardenti called the old alcoholic and asked him to bring up a bottle of whiskey, mineral water, and 3 glasses. At about 1 or 1:30 the old man heard someone ringing erratically from room 27. Judging by the way he looked this morning, though, he must have put away quite a few glasses by then, rotgut for sure. Anyway, the old man came up and knocked. No answer. He opened the door with his passkey, found everything all messed up the way it is now. The colonel was lying on the bed with a length of wire wound tight around his neck, his eyes staring. The old man ran downstairs, woke the desk clerk, but neither of them felt like coming back up. They tried to use the phone, but the line seemed to be dead. It was working perfectly this morning, but we'll take their word for it. The clerk ran out to call the police from the payphone on the corner while the old man hobbled across the square to a doctor's house. To make a long story short, they were gone for 20 minutes. When they got back, they waited downstairs, still frightened. Meanwhile, the doctor got dressed and arrived almost at the same time as the squad car. They went up to 27, and there was no one on the bed. "What do you mean, no one?" Belbo asked. "No corpse. The doctor went home, and the police found only what you see here. They questioned the old alcoholic and the clerk and got the story I just told you." "What of the two gentlemen who came in with Ardenti at 10 o'clock? They could have left any time between 11 and 1, and nobody would have noticed. Were they still in the room when the old man came in? Who knows? He stayed only a second, didn't look into the kitchen or the bathroom. Could they have left while the clerk and the alcoholic were out calling for help? Did they take the body with them? Not impossible. There's an outside staircase to the courtyard, and from the courtyard they could just walk out the front door, which opens into a side street. More important, was there really a body? Or did the colonel go out with the two men, at midnight, say, and the old alcoholic dreamed the whole thing? The clerk says it wouldn't be the first time the old man saw things that weren't there. A few years ago he saw a naked female guest hanged in her room, but half an hour later the woman came in, fresh as a daisy, and on the old man's cot they found one of those SM magazines. Who knows? Maybe he was peeping through the keyhole and saw a curtain stirring in the shadows. All we know for sure is that this room has been searched and Ardenti is missing. But I've already talked too much. Now it's your turn, Dr. Belbo. The only thing we found was a slip of paper on the floor by that little table. 2 p.m., Rakowski, Hotel Principe e Savoia. 4 p.m., Garamond, Dr. Belbo. You say he did come to see you. Tell me what happened. Chapter 22. The Knights of the Grail wanted to face no further questions. Wolfram von Eschenbach, Parzival, Romans 16:8-19. Belbo was brief. He repeated what he had already said on the phone. The colonel had told a hazy story about discovering evidence of a treasure and some documents he had found in France, but he hadn't said much more about it. He seemed to think he was in possession of a dangerous secret, and he wanted to make it public so he wouldn't be the only one who knew it. He mentioned the fact that others who had discovered the secret before him had disappeared mysteriously. He would show us the documents only if we guaranteed him a contract, but Belbo couldn't guarantee a contract without seeing something first. They vaguely agreed to get together again. The colonel had spoken of a meeting with someone named Rakowski, describing him as the editor of Les Cahiers du Mystère. The colonel wanted this Rakowski to write a preface for him, and apparently Rakowski had advised him to delay publication. The colonel hadn't told this man about the appointment at Garamond. That was all. "I see," De Angelis said. "What sort of impression did he make on you?"
"He seemed eccentric to us, and he spoke about his past in, well, an unrepentant tone. It included a spell in the Foreign Legion."
"He told you the truth, though not the whole truth. We were already keeping an eye on him, at least to some extent. We have so many such cases. First of all, Ardenti wasn't his real name, but he had a legitimate French passport. He started reappearing in Italy from time to time a few years ago, and was tentatively identified as a Captain Arcovegi, sentenced to death in absentia in 1945, collaboration with the SS. He sent some people to Dachau. They were keeping an eye on him in France, too. He was tried for fraud there and just managed to get off. We have an idea, but only an idea, mind you, that Ardenti at one point was calling himself Fasotti, that he's the Fasotti that a small industrialist in Peschiera Borromeo filed a complaint against last year. This Fasotti, or Ardenti, had convinced the industrialist that the treasure of Dongo, the legendary fascist gold reserve, was still lying at the bottom of Lake Como. Fasotti claimed to have identified the spot and said all he needed was a few tens of millions of lire for a couple of divers and a powerboat. Once he had the money, he vanished. Now you confirm that he had a kind of mania about treasures."
"And this Rakowski?"
"We checked. A Vladimir Rakowski was registered at the Principe e Savoia. French passport. Distinguished-looking gentleman. It matches the description the clerk here gave us. Alitalia says his name appeared on the passenger list for the first flight to Paris this morning. I've alerted Interpol. Annunziata, anything come in from Paris?"
"Nothing so far, sir."
"And that's it. So, Colonel Ardenti, or whatever his name is, arrived in Milan 4 days ago. We don't know what he did the first three, but yesterday at 2 he presumably saw Rakowski in the hotel, didn't tell him about going to see you, which is interesting. Then last night he came here, probably with the same Rakowski and another man, and after that your guess is as good as mine. Even if they didn't kill him, they certainly searched his room. What were they looking for?" "In his jacket. Which reminds me, if he went out, it was in shirt sleeves, because the jacket with his passport in the pocket is still here. But that doesn't make things any easier, because the old man says the colonel was stretched out on the bed in his jacket, unless it was a different jacket. God, I feel like I'm in a loony bin. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. In his jacket we found plenty of money, too much money, so it wasn't money they were looking for. And you gentlemen have given me the only lead. You say the colonel had some documents. What did they look like?"
"He was carrying a brown briefcase," Belbo said.
"It looked more red to me," I said. "Brown," Belbo insisted, "but I could be wrong."
"Red or brown," De Angelis said, "it's not here now. Last night's visitors must have taken it. The briefcase is what we have to concentrate on.
If you ask me, Ardenti wasn't trying to publish a book at all. He had probably come up with something he could blackmail Rakowski with, and talking about a publishing contract was a way of applying pressure. That would have been more his style. From there, any number of hypotheses are possible. The two men may have threatened him and left, and Ardenti was so scared that he fled into the night, leaving everything behind except the briefcase, which he clutched under his arm. But first, for some reason, he tried to make the old man think he was dead. It all sounds too much like a novel, and it doesn't account for the way the room was torn up. On the other hand, if the two men killed him and stole the briefcase, why would they also steal the corpse? Excuse me, but may I see your IDs?" He looked at my student card, turning it over a few times. "Philosophy student, eh?"
"There are lots of us," I said.
"Far too many. And you're studying the Templars. Suppose I wanted to get some background on them. What should I read?" I suggested two books, popular but fairly serious. I also told him he could find reliable information only up to the trial. After that, it was all raving nonsense. "I see," he said. "Now it's the Templars, too. One splinter group I haven't run into yet." The policeman named Annunziata came in with a telegram. "The reply from Paris, sir." De Angelis read it. "Great," he said. "No one in Paris has heard of Rakowski, and the passport number shows that it was stolen 2 years ago. Now we're really stuck. Monsieur Rakowski doesn't exist. You say he's the editor of a magazine. What was it called?" He made a note. "Well, we'll try, but I bet we find that the magazine doesn't exist either, or else it folded ages ago." "All right, gentlemen, thanks for your help. I may trouble you again at some point. Oh, yes, one last question. Did Ardenti indicate that he had connections with any political organization?" "No," Belbo said. "He seemed to have given up politics for treasures. And confidence games." He turned to me. "You seem not to have liked him much." "Not my style," I said, "but it wouldn't have occurred to me to strangle him with a length of wire, except in theory." "Naturally, too much trouble. Relax, Signor Casaubon, I'm not one of those cops who think all students are criminals. Good luck also on your thesis." "Excuse me," Belbo asked, "but just out of curiosity, are you homicide or political?" "Good question. My opposite number from homicide was here last night. After they found a bit more on Ardenti in the records, he turned the case over to me. Yes, I'm from political, but I'm really not sure I'm the right man. Life isn't simple the way it is in detective stories." "I guess not," Belbo said, shaking his hand. We left, but I was still troubled, not because of De Angelis, who seemed nice enough, but because for the first time in my life I found myself involved in something shady. I had lied, and so had Belbo. We parted at the door of the Garamond office, and we were both embarrassed. "We didn't do anything wrong," Belbo said defensively. "It won't make any difference if the police don't learn about Ingolf and the Cathars. It was all raving anyway. Maybe Ardenti had to disappear for other reasons. There could be 1,000 reasons. Maybe Rakowski was an Israeli secret service agent settling old scores. Or maybe he was sent by some big shot the colonel had conned. Or maybe they were in the Foreign Legion together and there was some old grudge. Or maybe Rakowski was an Algerian assassin. And maybe this Templar treasure story was only a minor episode in the life of our colonel. All right, the briefcase is missing, red or brown. By the way, it was good that you contradicted me. That made it clear we had only a quick glimpse of it." I said nothing, and Belbo didn't know how to conclude. "You'll say I've run away again, like Via Larga." "Nonsense. We did the right thing. I'll see you." I was sorry for him because he felt like a coward. But I didn't. I had learned in school that when you deal with the police, you lie, as a matter of principle. But a guilty conscience can poison a friendship. I didn't see Belbo for a long time after that. I was his remorse, and he was mine. I worked for another year and produced 250 typewritten pages on the trial of the Templars. It was then that I learned that a graduate student is less an object of suspicion than an undergraduate. Those were years when defending a thesis was considered evidence of respectful loyalty to the state, and you were treated with indulgence. In the months that followed, some students started using guns. The days of mass demonstrations in the open air were drawing to a close. I was short on ideals, but for that I had an alibi, because loving Amparo was like being in love with the Third World. Amparo was beautiful, Marxist, Brazilian, enthusiastic, disenchanted. She had a fellowship and splendidly mixed blood, all at the same time. I met her at a party and acted on impulse. "Excuse me," I said, "but I would like to make love to you." "You're a filthy male chauvinist pig." "Forget I said it." "Never. I'm a filthy feminist." She was going back to Brazil, and I didn't want to lose her. She put me in touch with the University of Rio, where the Italian department was looking for a lecturer. They offered me a 2-year contract with an option to renew. I didn't feel at home in Italy anymore. I accepted. Besides, I told myself, in the New World, I wouldn't run into any Templars. Wrong, I thought, Saturday evening, as I huddled in the periscope. Climbing the steps to the Garamond office had been like entering the palace. Vinna, Diatalevi used to say, is the place Chokmah builds as he spreads out from the primordial point. If Chokmah is the source, Vinna is the river that flows from it, separating into its various branches until they all empty into the great sea of the last Sephira. But in Vinna, all forms are already formed.